So I'm going to talk about what led up to the crisis and how the crisis makes us realize that the things about the theory that we've been learning all semester that ought to be slightly different. And I've been working on a new version of the theory for the last 10 years, what I call the leverage cycle, which I have to say didn't get very much attention 10 years ago, but which now seems to be, I don't know, it seems to be getting more attention. It's almost like life imitated art, really. It couldn't have turned out more like the theory than I would have expected. But so I'm going to tell you the facts and then try to fit a theory to it, and probably will spill over until Thursday. And I think Thursday, I won't spend that much time finishing. I'll have a review class if anyone's interested for the whole material. And I think when you see the critique of the theory, it might help put the theory in a little bit more perspective. But anyway, nothing of what I say these last 2 days you should feel is going to be on the exam. It's just more information that you might find interesting. So we talked last time, remember, at one of those special classes about the subprime mortgage market. And the idea was that you would pool together a bunch of loans. These are the, I can do this, I guess. You'd pool together a bunch of individual mortgages like this, and then you'd put them in a giant pool and then cut the pool up into a triple A bond, a double A bond, a single A bond, a triple B bond. And this is the over-collateralization and the residual. And I'm not going to go through the whole structure, but suffice it to say that the idea of this is you take individual loans, which are very risky. After all, these are subprime borrowers, so everyone knew that they were risky. And you create what's supposed to be an incredibly safe bond. The definition of AAA bond is that it has a 1 in 10,000 chance of going bankrupt in 10 years, of losing any principal in 10 years. That was the definition they claimed. I heard a talk about power failures last night, by the way, and the power grid, which went out all across from Cleveland to Manhattan in 2003, and they said that was an event that should happen once every 10 years. And then when you hear what happened in the event, you know, someone didn't trim a tree and the line sagged into the tree, and so then it shut itself off, and then a city next door, they had the same problem with someone not trimming a tree, and that line shut off, and once you have two or three lines shut off, the system automatically goes down. You know, it seems like it could happen much more often than once every 10 years. But anyway, it's the same thing here. This is supposed to be once every 10 years, 1 in 10,000 chance, and it happened in a giant way. So the idea of the AAAs are they're supposed to be very safe, because if the first house defaults, the first homeowner defaults, instead of paying back the 100 he owes, let's say he just stops paying. And then you throw the guy out of the house, but then you get to sell the house. The house is there as collateral for the loan. Now, the loan should have been 100. The house should have been worth much more than the 100. That's why it should have been collateral. So you should have had, you know, $120 of the house to sell. So even if the house went down by 33% to 80, that's still only a $20 loss, or let's say 20 cent loss on the dollar loan. And that 20 cents comes out of the triple B piece. So you notice how many losses do you have to have. If you're losing 20 cents on a house, to have $5 worth of losses, you've got to have 25 of the 100 houses go down, then another 25 of the $100 of the houses have to go down to lose this one, and then another whole bunch of them, 35 more to go down. So you've got to have like 85 houses going down before you touch the AAA, because the losses always come from the bottom and work their way up. So when they made these deals, they thought it was inconceivable that you'd have 85% of the houses defaulting, or that you'd lose so much more than 20% on each house, because things like that just hadn't happened before. And so it seemed like they were incredibly safe. Okay, so that was the structure. And the idea, again, was to take risky securities and, by securitizing them, create a whole bunch of apparently perfectly safe securities. Because, as we said, the goal of most investors is to invest in something that's completely safe. They don't have to worry about getting more in one state or more in another state. And this seemed like an ingenious way of turning $1 trillion of very risky subprime loans into, this is 81%, into $800 billion of very safe bonds and maybe riskier bonds down below that. So you could never find $1 trillion worth of people willing to lend to subprime borrowers. But you didn't have to after the securitization. You only had to, because $800 billion of the loans to them were by people who thought they were perfectly safe. You only had the guys buying these bonds down here who thought that they were running a very big risk. So the whole idea of securitization, the whole idea of the American financial system was to, was to create as many safe loans as possible. So you could put it a little bit more generally. I should have had this picture before. You could say if the states of the world, if you're here today and you might have many of these different states of the world tomorrow, some people know that they're going to be rich in some states and poor in other states. What they'd like to do is get the same amount in every state. They can do that by directly buying safe bonds. That's what everybody's trying to do. They're trying to hedge themselves to get completely safe bonds. Most people don't know how to hedge, so the financial system creates safe bonds for them. Other people, they do know how to hedge, but their cash flows are different in the different states because, for example, they run a business, and if interest rates go up, that might be bad for their business. If interest rates go down, it might be good for their business, so they've got different amounts of money in the different states. And then to create hedging instruments for these people, you'd like to create securities that pay a lot in states where they want the money, so that way they can buy hedging instruments. So the purpose of the financial system is to create cash flows in states that people want them. For the majority of people, that's the same thing in every state. For other people, it's something like the Arrow Securities, so they can buy money in the states when they're running short. And why is this connected to mortgages? Because how do you know that anyone's going to keep their promise to deliver money in those different states, or money in every state? How do they know they're going to keep, how do you know they, you know, the people making the promise will keep their promise? Well, you don't. That's why you need collateral. And the best collateral in the country is the houses. So the purpose of the financial system, as we said all through the course, is to create securities that pay off in different states of nature of the type people want and that are guaranteed, you know, so that people keep their promises, guaranteed by collateral. Houses is the best collateral, made it inevitable that the most sophisticated part of the market was going to turn into the mortgage market. So at first glance, you would think the most complicated part of the market is the stock market. But no, it turns out that collateral is the key, because without guaranteeing a promise, the promise isn't really very good. And so houses are the best collateral. So we'll see now that the change in the theory that I want to describe is what happens when you suppose people might break their promises and you have to take into account collateral. All right, but let's get back to the facts. So there are $1 trillion of these subprime mortgages around. So then what happened? I want to skip through this pretty quickly. People, you know, thought that it might be dangerous, and they wrote insurance on the subprime mortgages. So an insurance on a subprime mortgage, the CDS, credit default swap, would say if $1 of the principal of the BBB bond disappears, and we saw how that could happen, you take one homeowner who loses 20 cents, I mean, that will come out of this first, but after all this stuff is wiped out, 20 cents of the losses because the homeowner, instead of paying his dollar, you know, doesn't pay at all, the house is sold, you only get 80 cents back, that 20 cents comes out of the triple B. So the insurance would then say, the buyer of insurance would get to collect the 20 cents. So this seemed like another way for people, even in the triple B range, to guarantee their payments. Well, it turned out that that the writers of insurance didn't just write 20 cents in case there was a 20 cent loss, they might write $10 of insurance on the 20 cent loss. So these credit default swaps are getting very close to Arrow Securities. So the theoretically inclined economists who didn't think very far ahead in the Clinton administration, namely Larry Summers and people like that, Bob Rubin, they were ecstatic about these credit default swaps because to them it reminded them of Arrow Securities. And they thought, my gosh, the market is coming close to creating Arrow Securities. And isn't it great that people will now be able to hedge much better because they've got these Arrow Securities that they can trade? Okay. Now, the problem was that who's writing the insurance? The people writing the insurance are big banks and people like AIG. So they're saying, if you lose 20 cents, we'll pay the insurance. Now, of course, that's a promise, just like the promise to repay is, and that should have been collateralized. The trouble is that when AIG, as a AAA-rated company, wrote its promises, many of the people who bought the insurance just figured, you know, that's such a great company, it's obviously going to have the money, probably isn't going to happen anyway, so I'm not going to worry about the collateral. And they managed to make all these promises without putting up collateral to guarantee that they are going to keep their promises. This mistake that people make, well, it's probably not going to happen anyway, that we're going to even collect the insurance. You shouldn't have bought the insurance if you didn't think you were going to collect it. So obviously, even though it's a low probability event, you have to think, what will happen when it comes time to collect the insurance? Are they going to have the money? Now, many banks in Europe bought these things, and they're accused of having realized that they wouldn't be paid off. They only bought it so they could convince their regulators that they actually had a very sound bank and therefore didn't have to, you know, set aside capital. And they knew very well that they probably wouldn't be paid off. They just didn't think that it mattered because things wouldn't go that bad. So in any case, we've got, to circle back, we've got these subprime mortgages where you've written a bunch of apparently safe bonds, a lot of people, but not many, you know, 20% holding dangerous bonds, realizing that they're dangerous, and you've got a bunch of insurance written on the dangerous bonds, but of a bit much bigger, five times as big as the amount of dangerous bonds. So all these things, you know, are, if something goes wrong with that pool, these bonds are going to lose, and then the writers of insurance are also going to lose a huge amount of money. Okay, so what happened? Well, on top of that, you know, there was a CDO market where you took the triple B pieces and broke those up like you did before into bonds, more triple A's and so on. So if something happened to this original pool and the, you know, a lot of people, homes started defaulting, that would wipe out all the triple B's, forcing all these people to pay insurance. And on top of that, the CDO market, which is just the same thing done again, but using the triple B's as collateral, all these things would get wiped out, including the triple A's here. Okay, and then that wasn't enough. Wall Street then wrote CDO squareds on the triple B and A pieces of the CDOs. All right, so we talked all about this last time. So now I want to get into what happened. Any questions? Yes. No, a buyer knows very well where his AAA is coming from. A buyer has access to all. So if you were a buyer, so the hedge fund I work with, Ellington, was a big buyer of these kinds of things. And also, but you'll see what our strategy was. But we knew very well that, so we didn't, okay, so let's go back to this. We were a big buyer of things here, like these triple Bs we bought a lot of. So we could get for every single home in this pool, we knew the history, we know the loan to value, the income of the borrower, what zip code the borrower lives in. We know a tremendous amount of information about each one of these individual houses, how they've paid before, what kind of credit rating they have, all that information we have. And so we, you know, build a model of how reliable we think these borrowers are and what they're going to do. And so on the basis of that information, we can predict whether what we think the value of the triple B is going to be and whether it makes sense to buy insurance on it or not. So what was our strategy, by the way, in our hedge fund? Our strategy was take a pool where we think that the pool is really a good pool, buy the riskiest piece, which is down here, the residual that I described last time, for which there's no insurance. Okay, now it may be that the whole world goes to hell and we lose money on our residual. But, so how do we hedge that? What we do is then we take what we think is a bad pool of loans, you know, where they're from a county that we think people aren't as reliable, say, and we don't buy the residual. In fact, we do the opposite. We buy the insurance on the triple B. There is no insurance on the residual. So for the bad pool, we've bought the insurance. For the good pool, we've bought the residual. And so if we're right, the residual is going to pay a lot of money because these people aren't going to default. And if the bad pool is as bad as we think, they're going to default and we're going to collect the insurance. So we're going to win on both. And if the whole market collapses, well, our residual will go to zero, but so will the triple B in the bad pool and we'll collect insurance and so we'll be protected. So that was our strategy. So yes, the answer is you have a lot of information about what you're buying. Yeah, this up here is the AAA of a bad pool, but the people buying the AAA know exactly what's in the pool. Okay, now they may be dumb and not bother to think about it and just trust the AAA rating without thinking about it, but probably a lot of them did think about it. Okay, and if we take this pool, the CDO, these AAAs were held mostly by big banks. And you would have thought they were the most sophisticated of all the buyers because they're the ones creating the pools. So they certainly know what's in the pools. They're the ones who created this original pool here. They're the ones who underwrote those loans. And, you know, and so they're the ones, you know, they know everything about it, and they're the ones holding all these AAAs. So we're not talking about people who have no idea what they're doing. We're talking about people who supposedly do know what they're doing. All right, so that was the basis of the market. Now, what happened? Okay, so I can describe our hedging strategy and our models, but I'm not going to do that. Okay, so this was our strategy. You go long the residual, short the bad pool. Okay, now what happened? Here's what happened. So there was an index that was created in the beginning of 2006. You just put together a huge number of BBB bonds and AAA bonds of different pools and averaged their prices. That's the index. And so they're all 100, you see. And then in January of 2007, all of a sudden the market starts to go crazy. And by March and April, it's collapsed. These bonds, a lot of them, the triple Bs, have collapsed from 100, where everything was, all the way down to 60, just like that. In a few months, it went from 100 to 60. 100 here, 3 or 4 months later, it's 60. This is March of 2007. Okay, now, what was the stock market doing then? You might remember the stock market, S&P. So here's the stock market, too far in historical time. But anyway, here's the stock market. You know, it had this NASDAQ collapse. But this point right here is October 31st, 2007. So 10 months or 9 months later, the stock market reaches its peak. So all this time, from here up, the stock market is climbing and climbing and climbing. So the subprime mortgage market has collapsed, but clearly the rest of the population doesn't think that things are that bad. Okay? So now just to put everything in perspective, what else, where else are we? What other big housing, let's look at housing prices here. We're going to come back to this graph if you can see it. So this is 2000 here, this is 2009 here. Green is the housing, this is Shiller's housing index. So if you set it at 100 in 2000, up here at the very top, that's the middle of 2006, okay, it hit its peak and then started to come. So housing hit its peak in the middle of 2006, you know, third quarter of 2006. Subprime mortgages, and then sort of didn't come down very fast, but started to come down. Subprime mortgages collapsed in January of 2007, and the stock market started its very quick collapse in, you know, October, November 2007. So as first housing prices turned, then subprime mortgages collapsed, then the stock market 10 months later collapsed. Okay, so we have to explain all these things and what was going on. So in the, where was I? Okay, so this is a subprime market collapsing. Why did this market collapse? What happened to make them collapse? This is actually an example of the wonders, the wonderful nature of the American financial system. The fact the market collapsed is a great thing, because why did it collapse? Okay, what was the information that made people think that things were going to go down? Well, it was this this information, cumulative loss by reporting month. Okay, let's look at some. These are Countrywide. They're one of the bad guys. This is Country. That is, they're one of the ones whose loans went bad and the company went out of business basically and got bought by Bank of America. So look at delinquencies historically. So for 2003, these are Countrywide loans given in 2003. Okay, it's the brown thing. So here are their delinquencies, right? They start at zero naturally, and then they go up to 2% and they stay there as a function of the pool. Now, some people are, you know, some of those guys are defaulting and being thrown out of the pool. That's how delinquencies can go down. Also, people can start paying after being delinquent. Delinquent just means you're missing some payments. Okay, look at it 2004. Okay, they're still hardly doing anything. And then look at 2005. Well, all of a sudden, delinquencies start going up. At 2005, they're 5% by the end of 2007. But delinquencies, 5% delinquencies. We're just talking about people who missed a few payments. 5% delinquencies. They haven't actually been thrown out of their house. It takes 18 months. Nobody's lost anything. They've just been delinquent for a little while. Okay, so what was the catastrophe that made the market collapse? Well, this is it. So, WALA means weighted average age, okay? So look at the months. So you take things that were issued in, this is the securitization. They're bundled together in the beginning of 2006. This is the second half of 2006, but the loans actually started in 2005. They just didn't get bundled. The homeowners got their mortgages in 2005. They got securitized in 2006. So you look at the delinquencies, and you see that, you know, nothing happens the first 12 months. These are losses. And then eventually it goes to 1%. The losses go to 1%. We're not talking about giant numbers. Well, everybody saw that. Then they looked at the losses for things issued in second half of 2006, okay? And the losses, that's this blue line, they, are going to, we're talking about, 20 months later, they're going to 1% or 1.2%. You look at the things issued in 2007, which means that the loans you're really measuring from somewhere in the middle of 2006, okay, at a year, you're at 0.5%. And in the second half of 2007, you're at 0.2% losses. So no losses at all. So nothing horrible has happened, except for the fact there's an obvious pattern here. You know, it seems like every newer vintage is getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And so it was on that basis, just seeing things getting worse before there are any losses. Remember, these are very sophisticated people betting hundreds of millions of dollars. They're thinking hard about this. Even though nothing had happened yet, the market collapsed. Okay, so this collapse that happens here is before anybody's lost any money. Hardly anyone's been thrown out of their house. Nothing's happened in the economy. But the traders have already figured out things are on a bad course, things are going to look really bad, and the market collapsed, okay? So we had warning, this is the beginning of 2007, we're almost at the end of 2000, so it was almost 3 years ago, nearly 3 years ago, everybody should have known that the market had figured out that there was going to be a catastrophe in the subprime world, a real catastrophe, because the losses were going to be 40%. That's what they were expecting. You can't have losses like that unless you throw out, it's a huge number of people have to get thrown out of their houses, and you have to lose a huge amount of money on each house in order to get losses of 40%. Like I said, if you lose 50% on every loan, you have to throw 80% of the people out of their houses to get 40% losses. So this meant that people were expecting gigantic catastrophe. By the way, that was an exaggeration, because this is the triple B piece. So it meant the triple B piece was going to lose 40%. So, you know, the triple B piece is only protected by 6 or 8%. So it means the total losses would be 10%, which means that 10 or 15%, which means if you're losing 50% on a house, 30% of the people are going to be thrown out of their houses. Okay, so it's like 30% losses and 30% of the people thrown out of their houses. That was the expectation then. But that's still terrible. There were 5 million subprime people. So the market at this point is expecting 30% of them to be thrown out of their houses with 30% losses, even though the losses are 1% or less. So you can see how far-sighted the market is. So our government, everybody should have been warned right at this point that something was going to happen. Now, did the stock market realize this was such a catastrophe? Absolutely not, because the stock market waited till, you know, the end of 2007, which we're talking about here, before, you know, and now look at where the losses are in subprime bonds. Here the stock market started to go down. So it had all this warning that something horrible was happening in the mortgage market, but the stock market owners thought nothing of it. They thought, well, how could this possibly affect us? And only here do they start to catch on. Okay, so To give you an example of the losses, this is only up to December 2007, people kept announcing losses. You know, Merrill announced $9 billion, Citicorp announced $10 billion, then the next week another $10 million, UBS announced $3.7 billion, then another $10 billion, Goldman announced $5 billion, Morgan Stanley $4 billion. Every other day, someone was coming out saying that they lost all these billions, okay? And that was only in December 2007. The losses accelerated like crazy through 2008, so there were hundreds of billions of dollars lost. Now, the whole subprime market is only $1 trillion, but remember, there was all that insurance written on it, and who was writing the insurance? These very same people were the ones writing the insurance. So you not only lost the hundreds of billions in the subprime market, but also, multiply that by five, the hundreds of billions all these guys wrote in insurance and in CDS, AAAs that they held. Okay, so, all right, now let's say one other fact that's quite interesting. Okay, these are prepayments, okay? So I told you that in subprime loans, for the first 2 years, the subprime loan, you'd be locked into the loan, a huge penalty if you prepaid. But between year two and year three, you could prepay, you know, get a new loan, refinance it, and then in year three, the interest rate would jump. So what would people do? Well, people who'd made all their payments the first 2 years would be regarded as reliable payers, and so of course they would refinance. They'd no longer be such subprime people. They'd refinance into loans with lower interest because they'd be regarded as better credit risks. So if you go back to 2003, you see that after the second year, prepayments go up to 70%. So 70% of the people would refinance their loan between year two and three. In 2004, that's the pink one, the same thing happened. 60 or 70% of all those people, you know, over the course of a year, refinanced their loans. So that means that the original lenders got 70% of the money back. It's like a prepayment, like we have in mortgages. Well, in subprime, these guys had a huge incentive to do it once they proved that they're good people. And as I told you, most of the subprime borrowers are, you know, young people who had screwed up with their credit cards and things like that. And after they paid for a while, people would realize that, you know, they'd settle down and give them a new loan. But look what's happened to these numbers. So if you jump to 2007, all these things just collapsed. No more prepayments. And once there are no more prepayments, that means the lenders don't get their 70% back. So if you're a hedge fund figuring, you know, how much can I lose if I buy one of these subprime things, you know that between year two and year three, you're going to get 70% of your money back. So you can't lose more than 30%. All of a sudden, you're getting 10% of your money back, which means you could lose 90%. Okay, so why would that have happened? Well, we're going to come to that. Okay, so that's those are the basic facts. Okay, I don't have time to say more of that. Okay, so any questions about those basic facts? Now we need something to explain how they happened. Yes.
So ultimately, the slope of the line is getting steeper. Is that what you're saying? So
the
projected loss percentage, right?
Exactly. So people were realizing, yeah, that was all that it was. People just said to themselves every. It's exactly what I'm saying. That people said, look, you know, we know that losses are going to increase, but, you know, they're probably not going to get very far. You know, historically, they get to 3% or 4% or something like that. That's it. That's all we have to worry about. And it's early on, so it's not like we've seen any losses, but they just seem to be happening so much faster than they did before. Let's extrapolate that curve. Now, how do you extrapolate a curve like that? You know, there's so many ways you could extrapolate it. So the market extrapolated and thought, gosh, things are getting just much worse. And the market started to collapse. So you see, in real trading markets, people respond very quickly to very little information. I mean, their whole livelihood depends on it. It's all they're thinking about. And so they're coming up with quick conclusions, which, you know, in this case, like in many others, they're not so crazy. They're realizing something bad is happening, and they're acting very quickly. Okay, and so huge billions of dollars are being lost just on the basis of this amount of evidence. It's real, you know, I think this brings home how fast the market acts and how expectations about the future are driving prices, and therefore how much information. Remember, we said that if you just pay attention to the market, you can learn a lot. Well, we didn't learn that much. The whole stock market, they weren't paying attention to what was happening. The mortgage market was collapsing. That should have meant something, but they weren't paying attention to it. They, you know, nothing in the world seemed to change because there were no people on the streets yet. Okay, now there are people unemployed, there are people on the streets, there are going to be millions of guys on the streets pretty soon, homeowners on the streets. And of course, so now the stock market's caught on that things are really bad. All right, so let me, so any more questions about this? So now I want to talk about a way of understanding what happened, and then I'm going to end, so I'm going to go from more general to more specific. So I'm going to talk about a way of understanding what happened, and then we're going to talk concretely about how you would change the mathematics we've been doing all semester. So my view of all this is that it's the leverage cycle, okay, which is the leverage cycle, as I'll define it in a second, has to do with putting up collateral to make sure that you're going to pay. And so far in the course, we've paid no attention to that. And in all of economic theory, they never paid attention to that. You can read any one of those textbooks that we that you were on the reading list, you know, by all the great Nobel Prize winners and all the great financial economists, and you'll never see the word, hardly ever see the word collateral, and what the you'll never see what's the equilibrium amount of collateral, okay? And so that's been entirely missing. So in fact, if you think about macroeconomics and the Fed, they always tell you that if you know things go bad in the economy, reduce the interest rate. That's the way we can stimulate investment. We can raise the price of assets by lowering the interest rate. If we raise the interest rate, we'll lower the price of assets. We can always get the economy to boom or slow down by adjusting the interest rate. And our great, you know, the most important thing ever done in macroeconomics is to establish, you know, in theory and practice, is to establish the Federal Reserve and give it the responsibility of managing interest rates. Now, in my view, it should be managing collateral rates and not interest rates. And in fact, it has the power to manage, it's been given the authority to manage collateral rates when it was created, but it just never exercises that authority. Now, as I said in class, you know, Shakespeare already had this idea. You know, in The Merchant of Venice, as we said, they were haggling over the interest rate and not just over collateral, and Shakespeare anticipated the impatience theory of interest, and Shylock, who, you know, the modern reading of The Merchant of Venice is that it's about anti-Semitism and Shylock's supposed to be a bad guy. I don't think Shakespeare intended that at all. In fact, Shylock is much more sophisticated by far, much better understanding of what's going on in the world than either Antonio or, well, certainly than Antonio, who is The Merchant of Venice, and Bassanio's actually, I think, quite clever, although Harold Bloom makes Bassanio out to be an idiot and a dupe and can't imagine how Portia could possibly marry such a guy. But anyway, I think that Bassanio is a very attractive guy, and I think that Shylock is, he's the only one who really understands what's going on. So he explains the entire modern theory of impatience to Bassanio and Antonio and says that's why the interest rate should be, you know, high. And then they haggle over the collateral. And of course, Shakespeare, in my view, thought the collateral was much more important than the interest because nobody can remember the rate of interest they agreed on, but everybody remembers the pound of flesh collateral, okay? And remember that the play ends with, you know, the ships all sinking, apparently, and so whether, you know, should Shylock be take his collateral or not? And the court rules not that you should reduce the collateral or you shouldn't take the collateral, but you should have a different collateral. Should have been a pound of flesh, but not a drop of blood. So it's the responsibility of the judicial system and the regulatory body to monitor not the interest rate, not the amount of the borrowing, but the collateral that's put up for it. And that's exactly what my message is going to be. We have to manage the collateral. Okay, and so I wrote about this starting in 1997 and 2003, and then again 2008, and I've written with a bunch of people, and I have students who wrote on it, and Arujo and Pesco were two Brazilians who wrote about it. I gave a talk there in 1997, and I got them going on it. And then Bernanke himself wrote about collateral in the 90s, same time, even earlier than I was, but he didn't have the idea of leverage, okay, and collateral. So what do I, and collateral rate. He knew that you needed collateral, talked about collateral. We didn't talk about the ratio and the rate. So what do I mean by that? If you have a house that's worth $100, say, it's collateral for a loan, because if you don't pay the loan, they can take your house. Okay, so that's called no recourse collateral. If they take your house, but they can't go after you for anything more. Now that, in fact, is not in by law what happens, but in practice what happens. If you default on your mortgage, they'll take your house, but but they aren't going to come after you to try and get your, you know, income or something like that. So it's as if all they can do is take your house. In some states, explicitly by law, they can only take your house. In other states, you still owe the money, but they always just say, forget about it, we're just taking your house. So I'm going to assume that you just, they take your house and no more. Now, if the house is worth $100 and you borrow $80, then the collateral rate is 125%, because a $100 house is protecting an $80 loan. So it's 125%. The loan to value, it's an $80 loan on a $100 house, is 80%. The margin is the margin of safety. It's a $100 house. So the lender thinks that he's protected because he's holding a $100 house and he only gave you $20. Okay? So it's 20%. And the leverage is 5, because with $20 of cash, you've managed to buy a house worth 5 times as much, 100. So these numbers are all the same thing. You know, it's just different ways of saying the same thing. So I prefer leverage, but collateral rate, they're all the same thing. 5 is a $100 house, and you only paid $20. You borrowed the other 80. So with $20 of cash, you can manage to own a $100 asset. So the leverage is 5. Okay, so people who borrow a lot can own huge quantities of things even though they had hardly any money. So, as I say, when you're negotiating the loan, you have to negotiate the interest rate, but you also have to negotiate the leverage. You know, how much cash do you have to put down in order to get the house? How much can you borrow using the house as collateral? Now, in the standard theory that Fisher taught, that we've described in this class, you've got supply and demand determining the interest rate. Leverage never appeared, you know. We just always assumed everyone was going to repay their loan. So in my theory, supply and demand are going to determine both the interest rate and the leverage. Now that seems a little shocking, because how can one equation determine two variables? So I think it's for this reason that economists basically all these years ignored leverage, because they just didn't see any way to fit two variables with one equation, solve for two variables. So they just said, well, for simplicity, we'll assume everyone always repays. Okay, now, what is it that's going to determine leverage? Well, this is common sense, you know, as Fisher and Shakespeare before him said that interest rates are determined by impatience. In my view, leverage, there are many determinants, but the most important determinant is volatility. The volatility of the asset price. Why is that? Because if you've got a house of 100 protecting the $80 loan, if you think the housing price is going up and down and might, you know, fall below 80, then you're not going to feel very safe. If you think the housing price is rock solid at 100, you're going to feel very safe, and you'll even loan more than 80. Okay, so the volatility of the housing price obviously is what controls how safe the lender feels, and so volatility has got to be the most important determinant of leverage. Okay, but it's hard to see how to fit that into a supply and demand equation. So the theory, my theory, is going to be that the higher the leverage is, which supply and demand is going to determine, the higher the asset prices are, and the lower leverage is, the lower the asset prices are. Now, why should this be the case? Well, in my view, there are many different potential buyers, you know, let's say a continuum of potential buyers, and each of them has a different view of what the asset is worth. Some people, okay, and so you have this continuum. Now, let's, for simplicity even, suppose that everyone has a number in his head about what the asset's worth. That's what we did on the very first day. Everyone had a reservation price of the asset. And let's say, though, that they're willing to buy more than one football ticket. They're willing to buy as many football tickets as they can get, as long as the price is less than the reservation price. So what happens, the people who have the highest valuation naturally are going to buy the assets, and the people with low valuations are going to sell them. And somewhere there'll be a marginal guy. So people above here are going to be the buyers, and people below here are going to be the sellers. And what's the price going to be? It's going to be the valuation of this marginal guy. Because if the price, you know, he's marginal precisely because he's indifferent between being a buyer or seller, which means the price for him is just right. These guys up here think the price is too low. That's why they're buyers. These guys down here think the price is too high. That's why they're sellers. So this is all consistent with what we've saw in the football ticket example. Now, the one little twist is, where does this have to be? Well, it depends on how much money these guys up here have. So Fisher actually said this, if you make people who are, you know, really like to consume now richer, you're going to get a different interest rate. Or if you make, you know, if you make the patient people richer, you'll have a lower interest rate. Well, the same logic here. If you make the natural buyers richer, you're not going to need as many of them to buy the assets, and the marginal guy will go up here, and the price will rise, not because the payoffs of the asset have changed, but because the marginal buyer has gone up. So to put it in, put it another way, more important way, if it's easier to borrow because leverage is higher, so you can buy that $100 house with only $10 down instead of $20 down, then each of these natural buyers, instead of being able to afford to buy one house, can buy two houses or two mortgage securities or buy a house that's twice as big. So the natural buyers with a lot of leverage, you'll only have a few of them will be able to buy all the assets, and the marginal buyer will be very high, and the price will be very high. If there's no leverage and no borrowing, it's going to take a lot of them to buy all the assets, and the marginal buyer will be down here, and the price will be very low. So leverage is clearly going to affect the price. And notice how shocking this is. You know, what would Fisher say about this? So this sounds like such common sense. How could this be wrong? It sounds like so obvious. Okay, but now why didn't anybody say this before? Why didn't Fisher say this? Because remember what Fisher said. He said the price of every asset is the fundamental value of the cash flows. You take the future cash flows and you discount them by the interest rate, say, and that's what the price is. I'm saying even if the interest rate doesn't change, you just change the amount of leverage. So these natural buyers at the top are going to be able, fewer of them are going to be able to buy all the assets, then that's going to make the price higher. So the price is not going to be equal to the fundamental value. In fact, there isn't a fundamental value. It all depends on the different opinions of the different people. So what are the reasons they differ? Why should there be people who disagree about what the value is? I think that there are basically five reasons, four of them anyway, are: one, these people, let's say, are more risk tolerant than the people down here. So the people down here are so scared to hold these assets because they might pay low numbers, low payoffs in some states and high payoffs in other states. Okay, so that assumes that they can't insure themselves against everything. So that's another crucial ingredient to my theory, which I'm not going to, you know, in the background here is the idea there's not insurance for everything. So the asset here is going to be regarded as risky if it pays less in some states than other. So because some people are less risk averse, they're more risk tolerant, they're going to be willing to pay more for the asset. That's one reason. Another reason is these people might just be more optimistic than these people. So far, we've assumed that everybody believed in the same probabilities. What if these guys' probability of the upstate is always higher than these guys' probability of the upstate? Then they're going to be willing to pay more than these guys are. Another reason might be these people simply like the asset. They like living in the house. These people are the New York bankers. They're just lending money. They couldn't care less about living in the house. The house to them is just a source of income. For these people, they really want to live in the house. So another thing could be some people just have more expertise. They know how to read all these, you know, statements of loan. You know, they can analyze the loan level data, and these people don't have the time, or, you know, it gives them a headache, or they don't know how to find the loan level data to go through house by house who the homeowners are and how reliable they are. So naturally they're going to be scared of buying because they're going to figure these guys know more than they do. Okay, so these are all different reasons why some people would be willing to pay more than other people. Okay, and so therefore, as I say, in the standard theory, the asset price is supposed to be the fundamental value. We don't talk very much about the heterogeneity of the people and how that makes the definition of fundamental value hard to maintain. So in my theory, in short, in equilibrium, in normal times or, you know, good times, there's going to be too much leverage and therefore too high asset prices. And in bad times, there's going to be too little leverage and therefore too low asset prices. And this recurs over and over again. And it's what I call the leverage cycle, what I call the leverage cycle. Now, let me give you an example of what people really had to pay for these things. So for a bank buying a AAA security, there's regulation which forces them to put a certain amount of cash down. Okay, so, you know, they have their depositors' money, so they can buy things with depositors' money, but they have to put some of their own capital down. So how much do they have to put down? 1.6%. So they could leverage 60 to 1, $100 asset, they only paid $1.6 in cash. If you look at all the so-called toxic mortgage securities, of which there were $2.5 trillion, these are the things that crushed all the banks that they held, I went through security by security and made a guess as to how much cash was put down by the buyer of each of those securities. And on average, I got, so this is not absolutely accurate, there are a lot of guesses, but I got 16 to 1 as the leverage. So that meant that, if that number's right, it means $150 billion of cash was paid and $2.35 trillion was borrowed. Okay, that's 16 to 1 leverage. So that means that, you know, think about it. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, two people by themselves in 2006, had almost $150 billion. So that means two guys in the whole economy could have bought every single toxic mortgage security because they could have borrowed the rest of the money they needed to buy. So when you think of where this line is, what I'm saying is that for all the mortgage securities, all the toxic mortgage securities, the subprime, the, you know, the Alt-A, all those supposedly dangerous securities, you could have had the marginal buyer way up here. That's all that was required. Those are the only number of people, this top little echelon of people bought all those securities, could have bought all those securities because they had enough money to do it. Okay, and they hardly had to put anything down. So if you look at, all right, the same was true with housing. Now let's look at this theory a little bit. So I should have, sorry, I could have put this in a better thing. Okay, so I give all these talks with Shiller for alumni. And, you know, during the crisis, we haven't given one in a while, but there was, you know, lots of them. Like every month or 2 months, we'd be giving one of these talks, and they'd bring in all these donors to say, you know, Yale needs your money now. And they'd say, we don't have any money. So anyhow, I'm just joking. So we'd have a lot of these talks, and Shiller would always put up the green graph. So on the right-hand side, I showed you this before. It's his famous diagram. He did a brilliant thing. He decided to collect data on every transaction. Every time someone purchased a house, he'd keep track of it because it's all public information, and then compare it to the same house that was sold before, and do a few other tricks I don't have time to explain, to make an index of the housing prices in the whole country. And so he done this going back, you know, many years. But starting in 2000, the thing that he called attention to before anybody said, look at this line, the housing price index from 2000 to 2006, it's gone up by almost 100%. The housing index was 100 in 2000 when it started. That's 110, sorry, this is 100. It's 100 when it started here in 2000, and it goes up to 190 in 2006. That's 90% in 6 years. You know, that's to almost double in 6 years, that means it's gone up, 12% a year or something. Okay, so a staggering increase in the price of housing. And then it started to go down. So he called attention to this already as it was coming up. So, you know, 2004, 2005, he was saying, my gosh, there's a bubble, it's going crazy. And he'd say, everybody's nuts. You know, the people in Americans, there's an irrational exuberance, and people are so crazy that they just think things are always going to go up, and the price is going up higher and higher and higher. And then, you know, when it got so high, the narrative changed. People started getting worried, and they started telling everyone the world was coming to an end, and the prices went down and down and down because we have irrational exuberance, and, you know, things are picking up a little bit, but we don't know whether people are irrationally exuberant or pessimistic or they're blipping, but anyway, they're irrational. So I say, so that's a story that has a certain compelling nature to it, and he deserves a lot of credit for calling attention to it. But in my story, I say these prices are related to leverage. So I went through every loan, loan by loan, that wasn't a government loan. So these are private loans. You can't get the data on government loans. So on private loans, you know, every time someone took out a mortgage, you have to, you know, they put it into a, you know, so they were selling the loan, so therefore they published the data. You know what the appraised value of the house was, or the sale price if they were buying it for the first time, and you know what all the loans are. So I added up the value of all the loans, and I divided it by the price of the house, and I subtracted it off to get what the down payment was, the cash down payment. So this is 2% down, 4% down, 6% down, or if you take 100% minus this, this is, you know, the loan to value. So this is 100%. You've borrowed everything. Here you borrowed 98% of the value, 96% of the house, 94% of the house, etc. Okay, so in 2000, these are slightly riskier people. They're putting down 14%. Okay, not amazingly, they're putting down 14%. So it's 7-to-1 leverage. But then look what happened. The leverage went up and up and up and up and up and up. And then it was in 2006, less than 3% down. These people were 30-to-1 leveraged. I said the securities market was 16-to-1 leveraged, the AAA part 60-to-1 leveraged. Here, they're 30-to-1 leveraged. And so the prices went up. But yes, the prices went up because the leverage went up. It was so, you hardly had to put any money down. That's why people were willing to pay to buy such expensive houses, because they weren't actually putting that much money down. Okay, and then leverage collapsed like this, and you had to put more and more money down, and then the whole market for you can't get a loan basically anymore unless you're getting a government loan. And so leverage collapsed, and the housing prices went down. You know, leverage was collapsing faster and in front of housing prices. So I think it's the leverage which is a crucial determinant of the price, and not irrational exuberance, although I think there is irrational exuberance, but I think leverage is what's underneath it and more basic. Now let's do the same thing with prices. So these, we did the subprime index before. This red line is the prime index. So we're talking about things at the very, not subprime homeowners, but prime, people with brilliant credit ratings and stuff. So even now, you know, years, 3 years after the crisis has started, the losses on these pools are still in the single digits. Okay, 5%, 6%, things like that. And most of these, 8% maybe, and most of these are the top piece of a pool of prime borrowers. So most of these loans are, they're protected by 8% of, the bottom piece. So you have to go through 8% losses before you touch them at all. So it's just inconceivable that you'd see 40% losses. But so what happened? These bonds were at 100. This is 100 over here. The price is 100. Okay, they're at 100. Now, the interest rate is changing, and the prices are going up and down because they're supposed to be floaters, which always pay more or less depending on the interest rate. So they should be locked in at 100, but they're not floating exactly on the same time. You know, they don't change their float so fast. So the price is going up and down because of that. But it's clear that nobody thinks there are going to be any losses. And then all of a sudden, in 2007, but later, this is much later than the subprime market collapsed, these prices collapse. And they collapse all the way to 60. Shocking. It's just inconceivable, I think, that people could have thought there were going to be 40% losses, or that everybody could have thought there were going to be 40% losses. And then they've shot back up to 80. So there's been a huge gain. So if you look at a typical hedge fund, like Ellington, you'll see that we lost a lot of money, and now we've made a huge amount of money. Okay, now where did, so that was not such brilliant hedging, but anyway, so, but now why did these prices collapse and go back up? Is that people just got totally irrationally pessimistic, and then some, and then they said, oh, things can't really be that bad, and things got better? Well, let's look at the leverage. Okay, what is the down payment? The same thing as before on AAA securities. Now, amazingly, the Fed has never kept these numbers. So, and they're still not keeping these numbers. So I testified in front of Ben Bernanke and the Board of Governors in October 2008. There were several of us, but it was for 4.5 hours. And and I showed them this graph. So this graph is at my hedge fund, Ellington. It's for just a bunch of securities that were used to trading. It's how much they were offering to lend us, what the down payment was they were insisting if we wanted to leverage as much as we could. So we didn't leverage anything like that, but this is what they were offering us on the kinds of securities that we're interested in. Okay, so this is not the greatest data because we're only looking at what we're interested in, and we're only looking at the offers made to us. So, but look what happened. In 98, when there was a leverage crisis, that was the last one. I must have skipped a slide where I said the last leverage cycle ended in 98. It was 10% down. That means 10-to-1 leverage. Then suddenly it went to 40% down. So leverage drastically dropped. The down payment, the margin, radically increased for a few months during the crisis. Then it went back to 10%. Then we had 10% down for a long time. That's 10-to-1 leverage. And then for a couple years, it became 5-to-1 leverage. So 5% down means 20 to 1 leverage, okay? And so, you know, the leverage had drastically increased. And then leverage suddenly started collapsing, and lenders asked for more and more down payments, more and more down payments, and leverage was just collapsing, okay? And the prices, see, it happened ahead of the prices, and then leverage actually picked up here and went down again, and then this graph is quite old now, May, I should have gotten updated it, leverage has gone way up again, and the prices have gone way up. So you see leverage goes down, the prices go down, leverage goes up, the prices go up, and leverage is still heading up, and the prices are much higher. So that's my view, it's leverage that's determining a lot of these things, okay? And all right, so as I said, there's recurring leverage cycles. In 1998, there was a leverage cycle. That's when long-term capital, so there was a book on the collapse of long-term capital that Lowenstein wrote that's on the reading list. Before that was Orange County. Remember, my firm Kidder Peabody went out of business in 1994, and you know, the end of 94, the beginning of 94, Orange County got bankrupted, partly thanks to buying securities from Kidder Peabody. And so that was, you know, some of you may live in Orange County. In any case, that was the derivatives crisis. And there was, in 1987, there was a stock market crash. So anyway, it's hard to document all the historical leverage cycles because the Fed has never kept this data. And most other firms don't keep their historical data. We at Ellington realized after 98 that this was a huge problem, leverage, and so we kept all the historical data. That's when I wrote my first paper on leverage and collateral and that being a crucial ingredient of the department. So we have this data and practically nobody else has. So for me, the most important thing, the first step the Fed should do is keep track of the leverage that's being asked, you know, allowed for, the margins that are being demanded on every security, housing and securities. And I heard this talk I told you last night on the collapse of the electric grid in 2003. And so I said, well, you know, what have you done? Obviously, the obvious question, everyone wanted to know. So what have you done to make it safer? And they said, the one thing they did is now they've spent tens and tens of millions of dollars getting more data. So they now monitor every single power line in real time. They had farmed that out to other people before, and they weren't very careful about it. Now they're incredibly careful about monitoring every single line. So as soon as one line goes down, they switch the electricity, and they move it evenly across a bunch of other lines. In the old days, when a power line went down, the grid automatically, the sort of electricity went, the power went to the next closest place, and that would overload the next closest one and maybe make that one go down. Now if they know it's gone down, they choose how to redivide it. I mean, it's automatic, you know, dividing them. But the point is you can't do all that without information. And they're spending tens of millions of dollars monitoring everything, and we still are not monitoring what leverage is. I think it's a shocking thing. We should be monitoring leverage, and then we should be regulating it. And instead, we haven't even begun to monitor it, much less to figure out how to regulate it. Now, why was the leverage cycle, I said this recurs over and over again, so why was the leverage cycle so bad in this time than it was before? So this is my short version. I have a long version of this. The short version is because leverage got higher than it ever did before. And there are lots of reasons why leverage got higher than it ever did before. We had this period of low volatility for a long time. Okay, so it made it higher. We then had securitization, which we didn't have before. So, you know, a subprime borrower would have had to put down a huge down payment in the old days because people would have regarded it as such a risky thing. But once we packaged all the subprime loans together in a big security, and you could, you know, the AAA guy got the best of the houses, not each house, not a share of every house, but only a share of the very best houses, it all of a sudden became a much safer loan, and so as you could borrow a lot more money against it, okay, against that AAA loan. So the AAA piece, using that as collateral, you could borrow a lot of money, whereas using a single subprime, a big percentage of the price of the AAA thing, you could borrow, whereas if you had a single subprime loan, people would never lend more than, you know, 50% of the value of the house or something. Okay, the second reason why things were so bad was because we had a double leverage cycle. We had leverage shooting through the roof, not just in securities as it had before, as I showed you in 98, where, you know, it was at 10% down, and then it was a collapse to 40% down, and then back to 10% down. That was a big change, you know, in the crisis stage, leverage collapsed. But here we had in housing as well. where there is a feedback between the two. So why is it that all these people stopped being able to refinance their loans in 2007, which contributed so much to the losses? It's not because the interest rates were suddenly too high for them. Those didn't change at all. It's that the lenders suddenly demanded a much bigger down payment. Instead of 3% down, they had to put 25% down, and they couldn't afford to do it, so they couldn't refinance their loan. They didn't have the cash, so they were stuck with the old loan, and so the original lender was in much more jeopardy. Okay, and then the last thing is the CDS market. So I have to explain this. This is why it's going to spill over into next time. So these insurance things, there are many ways of interpreting what they did and why they were so dangerous, but one of them is that they allowed people to write insurance to lose huge amounts of money, but more interest, okay, so that's an obvious thing. That's why the losses were so big, but more interesting than that, they allowed the pessimists to leverage themselves, because in our old story from way back here, in this story, remember I said that the natural buyers, you'd have fewer of them if they could leverage a lot. Okay, so what were these guys down here doing? Well, they couldn't do anything except sell the assets and maybe make the loans. There was no way they're negative. You know, as the price got higher and higher, these guys down here presumably were getting more and more disgusted and thinking, well, this market's ridiculous. I mean, the price is way too high. We don't want to buy here. And I've talked to a lot of insurance companies like Northwestern Mutual Life, the guy who runs that, he said, we used to be a big buyer of mortgage securities and subprime mortgages and stuff in 2004, and the price got so high in 2006, to us it became ridiculous, so we just dropped out of the market. But dropping out of the market is one thing. What if they could bet against the market? Well, they had no opportunity to do that before. They couldn't express their negative view, but starting in 2005, where this CDS market really took off, they could suddenly express their negative view. So in my view, in my opinion, what happened was that at the end of 2005, the pessimists for the first time were able to bet on the market going down. And so that's what started to make prices go down because of the CDS market. When prices started to go down, the mortgage securities that had been sold with all that leverage for high prices started to go down in price. That meant that new securitizations weren't worth it. You couldn't make the profit that we were talking about before, you know, putting all these things together and selling off the bonds. The bonds were being sold for a lower price. You couldn't lend all that money to these people you were getting the money to lend to the people by selling the bonds. If you sell the bonds at a lower price, you don't have the money to lend to the people. So in order to make the bonds sell for a higher price, they demanded that the homeowners put up more collateral. And so that's why, that's how things, and then that meant the homeowners couldn't refinance, and then that started to make the world more dangerous, and that's why then on securities, the lenders on securities reduced the leverage, and then the whole thing started to spiral. That's my story of how the thing started. So let's say that. In the bottom of the leverage cycle, the same bad three things always happen. Number one, there's scary bad news that creates more uncertainty and more disagreement. Okay, so it wasn't just that people thought that losses were going to go from 40% to 20% on subprime mortgages. It's that they went from 4% expected with a range of 1 to 5% to 30%, but maybe they would be 80% the losses. There was a huge volatility. You know, nobody really knew what the hell was going to happen. They had to extrapolate those curves. How do you know how to extrapolate? You know, for a decade, the curves have been flat. Suddenly, they're starting to accelerate. How do you know how to extrapolate them? There's huge uncertainty, and because, you know, huge volatility, and so naturally, the lenders are going to be much more nervous and lend only with much more collateral. Once the lenders lend with much more collateral, those people at the top can't afford to buy things anymore. They're going to have to sell, okay? And so there's deleveraging, sorry. And the people at the top are going to have to sell. But the price is going to go down. And because they borrowed money, you know, and using an asset as collateral, they're leveraged. We talk about that. Their losses are going to be gigantic because they're betting, essentially, on things going up and things are going down. So they lost a huge amount of money. Okay, so this is always the same thing. There's scary bad news, margins get tougher, and the most optimistic leveraged buyers are the ones who got crushed because they were betting on things going up, and they go bankrupt. Okay, so now what's so bad about this? I'm running out of time here. Okay, and I haven't gotten to how the math is going to change. So what's so bad? So I'm going to talk for 4 more minutes and hand back the exams, or should I just hand back the exams right now? Okay, I'll talk 4 more minutes. Some of you aren't going to come next time. So I'm going to do how the math, maybe most of you, so I'll do how the math changes next time. So what's so bad about the leverage cycle? So let's just think about what all the bad things that happen. Number one, you can have a tiny group of people at the top controlling the price because they can borrow so much money. Now, we've always assumed that everybody was rational. What if these buyers are kind of crazy? A few guys can make the price skyrocket because they can borrow so much money. Okay? Now, once they do that and they're making the prices of assets skyrocket, people are going to build more of those assets. So they're going to use real resources to build projects that are probably, you know, crazy and are going to be very costly to reverse. Okay, but let's leave aside now people being crazy. What else happens in the leverage cycle? Well, in the leverage cycle, when you're leveraged a lot, as we said, you know, that's going on the Tobin diagram to the right. It's like borrowing money to bet in the stocks. That means if the stocks go up, you multiply your winnings, and if the stock go down, you multiply your losses. So in the leverage cycle, people who are lucky, if things keep going up, they get incredibly rich. You know, it's a tremendous mystery in economics. Why is it that inequality, increased so much? Well, one of the reasons, I think, is the leverage cycle, that, you know, people were betting and making more and more money, and so that's why inequality was helping to spread inequality. Now, another thing is, the worst, probably the biggest problem, is that once the asset prices fall, everything gets hard to do. So if you want to get a new credit card, what does it mean to get a credit card? It means you sell your promise, right, to a buyer. Now, why should a buyer buy your promise for 100? You know, you're promising to pay back in the future, so he's paying 100 for you, when the very same promise that someone made 6 months ago is selling for 65 because the prices have all collapsed. They're not going to buy the new promises when they can buy the old promises at such a low price. Who's going to buy a new mortgage when the old mortgages are selling at 65? Who's going to buy a new auto loan when the old auto loans are selling so low? So nobody can get a new loan. Nobody can get a new, can sell a new promise. And no business can sell its promise. They're old businesses that everybody understands, whose bonds are out there being traded at very low prices. The investors are going to all buy the old assets, not the new assets. That's why activity collapses. Okay, and then another terrible thing is that what if the optimists are indispensable to the economy, like the big banks? They go out of business and then everything topples. Well, why didn't the big banks take that into account? Shouldn't they have realized the losses would be so big and try to protect themselves? Well, they're not taking into account that when they go under and the managers lose a lot of money, that there are other people they don't care about, like all their workers and the rest of the economy, that's losing even more that they're not paying attention to. So they're not internalizing all the losses when they go out of business. Now, another incredibly bad thing is what we're suffering from now is debt overhang. There are a tremendous number of people, homeowners to name one, who are underwater. That means they owe more money than their house is worth. Or banks that have more debts than the value of the assets they hold. Or firms that have more debt than the value of the assets they hold. Now, many of these people don't just go bankrupt. They keep going because maybe they'll get lucky. You know, maybe some miracle will happen and the stuff they own is going to go up in value. So they don't stop. They still exist, but they're what people have called zombies. They're not doing anything productive because what's the point in fixing up your house if more than likely you're going to end up losing it anyway? So all these homeowners are not doing anything to take care of their houses. The banks aren't making loans. These firms aren't making productive investments because they know they're so far underwater. So another horrible thing happens is that, you know, if you try to collect the collateral, when people default, it's a costly operation. So in subprime loans, it takes 18 months to throw somebody out of their house. So during those 18 months, the guy's not paying his mortgage, he's not paying his taxes, all of which you have to make up for. He's trashing the house, or if he doesn't trash it, he leaves the house and some neighbor trashes it and rips out everything in the house. The average subprime loan, when you force someone out of their house and sell it, you get back 1/4 of the value of the house now. You know, at the beginning, people assumed it could never be less than 80%. Now it's 1/4. Okay, now, and then there's other more complicated things that can go wrong, which I'm going to skip over. Okay, so let's just see what happens now with housing. So what is it that's happening with housing? If you look at people underwater, why are people defaulting on their houses? It's because they're underwater. So here is for every different kind of mortgage, starting at subprime and going down to prime. These are except government loans. This is the fraction of people who default every month, not every year. And here's their loan to value. So how did I figure out the loan to value? I had to look at all the original loans. I did this house by house, or Ellington, my hedge fund, actually, the guys there who were former students here. They actually figured all this out. They went house by house. They got what the combined loan, you know, the loan sizes were on all the houses. And then using the Shiller index, they know what the house was bought for. And assuming the zip code index dropped by 20%, they figured every house in the index went down by 20%. So they could get the current value of the house. So this is the ratio of the loan to the current value of the house. Current combined loan to value ratio. So 140 means the loans altogether, first and second loans, are 140% of what they estimate the value of the house is. So look at what happens. If you're subprime and you've got that, I can't see my, this is 140 is over here somewhere, right? You're defaulting more than 6% a month. If you're 160, you're defaulting at 8%. Every month, 8% of those people are becoming serious delinquent and probably will never repay. 8% a month. In 1 year, they're all going to be gone. Okay, so you can see this is a shocking, you know, it's shockingly sensitive to loan to value. It's not that people are defaulting because they lost their jobs. They're defaulting because it's not worth it for them to pay. They're not stupid. Why should they pay $160,000 when the house is only worth $100,000? It's just, how can they, you know, times are tough. What are they going to do? Tell their children, well, we can't go to you, we can't feed you, you can't go to school because, you know, daddy and mommy have to pay this thing where we don't really have to pay it. They're not going to do it. So somehow, I couldn't convince Larry Summers of this. I tried hard. I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in October of 2008. I wrote another one in October of 2008, then March of 2009, saying that the only way to save the housing market was to write down principal. Okay, now writing down principal means saying if the loan is $160,000, maybe the house used to be $200,000, the house is only $100,000 now, you just say, okay, we're writing off $80,000 of the loan. It's now only $80,000 that the homeowner owes. Now, who's going to pay for the lost $80,000? I say nobody has to pay for it. The government doesn't have to pay a penny. The bondholder, the lender, would be better off writing down the loan to $80,000 than throwing the guy out of the house and getting $40,000 in the end. Because once the loan is written down to $80,000, the homeowner now has $20,000 of equity in the house. He'll either work hard, you know, to fix it up and spruce it up and sell it for $100,000, or he'll actually pay the $80,000. Either way, the lender's going to get $80,000, not $40,000. So this is a win-win, as I called it in the editorial with Susan Cognac. It's a win, a co-author, a law professor at BU. It's a win-win situation, and it's not happening, okay? And it's not happening because the loans are all in the hands of the servicers. So remember I said there was this big pool with all the loans in them, and then, you know, there were the bonds. And so the bondholders, these are the people who would like to see the principal written down, but the bondholders don't know who the homeowners are and aren't legally allowed to talk to them. There's a servicer in the middle who's a big bank who's writing the letter saying pay up, and if they pay up, they distribute the money to the bondholders, and if they don't pay up, the servicer throws them out of the house. The servicer, the big bank, doesn't own the loans. They're getting paid a percentage, like 0.5% of the principal. So they have no incentive to write down these loans. If they write down the loan in half, they lose half their fee. If they write down the loan to $80,000, then the guy sells the house. They don't service the house anymore. They lose all their fees. Instead, Obama, thanks to, you know, my classmate Larry Summers and all his other advisors, they've given these servicers license not to write down any loans, but to, you know, pretend that they're writing down the interest on the loans. Now, that would be great if that's actually what's happening. The servicers are basically not even kicking the people out of their houses. So these people are not paying anything now. There are millions of them not paying anything, still living in their houses. In a year or two, they're going to get thrown out, okay? Of course, they're not going to pay. This is the ideal situation for the servicer because he's still collecting his fee. The homeowners can't sell, they don't want to leave because they're not paying anything, and the bondholders are getting screwed. So it's a catastrophe. And finally, after a year, if you read the op-eds in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, in the last week or two, there have been deluged with people saying, why aren't they writing down principal? Okay, so this is something that a year or two ago, I already advocated, anyone with any common sense would have seen that was what was inevitably going to happen, and we didn't do anything about it. Okay, so I got one more minute to finish. So what should we do about the leverage cycle? Well, the thing to do about the leverage cycle is to reverse the three bad things that happened in the leverage cycle. Okay, the first one was that, you know, there was too little, okay, the most important one is leverage collapsed. So the bank, the Fed has to go and increase leverage. So it used to be, you know, 30 to 1 or 20 to 1. Now it's close to 1 to 1 on many assets, although it's gone up a little bit. So the Fed has actually done something about this. What does it have to do? Not lend at lower interest. The Fed cut the interest rate to zero and said, look how great we are. Well, that did nothing practically. All it did, the reason the Fed has cut the interest rate to zero is to give money to the big banks, because the banks have to pay depositors like you and me. Now in your checking account or savings account, you're getting zero practically because the Fed lowered the interest rate to zero. That means the banks make money because they don't have to waste any money giving it to their depositors. Okay, that's the reason why the interest rate went down to zero. And they try to dupe the public into thinking it's because it's a Keynesian stimulus. It's not stimulating anything, basically. What you have to do is lend with less collateral. And the banks aren't willing to do it. The Fed has to go around the banks and lend with less collateral, which I'm out of time, so I can't explain how it's actually done that. And that's one of the big reasons leverage is starting to go up. Secondly, you have to replace some of the natural buyers, okay, who have gone out of business, the ones at the top who are doing all the buying. Without them, the price is going to be worth much less. The government is going to have to do some buying. So through the PPIP program and other things, it is doing some of that. And then finally, the first thing, the most important thing, the crisis began with housing. Housing is the first thing you have to do to lessen the instability and the uncertainty in the economy. It's now started with housing and it's spread to other people who are underwater. That's where all the uncertainty comes from. So we have to straighten out who's going to go out of business and who's not going to go out of business. We have to write down principal of the homes. That's the way to reduce that uncertainty. And in the long run, we have to prevent the next leverage cycle by never letting leverage get so high. So we have to keep the data and we have to prevent people from asking for so little margins.